Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode. This week, we're going to be taking a look at 1986 film Highlander, directed by Russell McKay, starring Christopher Lambert, Sean Connery, and the redoubtable Clancy Brown. Little background on Highlander. It was written and conceived by a guy named Gregory Wyden. He wrote this while at film school. I guess the germ of the idea was back in film school, like in the late 60s, believe it or not, early 70s. And he wrote it as his writing class project. And it was germinated, apparently, when he was traveling through Scotland on his summer vacation. Supposedly, at one point, he was standing in front of a suit of armor and wondered what it would be like if the guy was alive, you know, who was in the armor that day. And then everything kind of fell into place. He had the idea about their immortals and their conflict with each other. Sold it for 200 thou back in the day. Was finally bought and picked up and brought to the screen by Russell Mulcahy. The soundtrack was done by rock band Queen. And it's a really cool soundtrack. Really, some very memorable songs in this. And they're peppered in with certain dramatic moments in the film. And a bit about Russell Mulcahy. He's had a bit of a checkered career. He was mostly a music video director, which you can tell when you watch this film, that he was very much, you know, part of the progenitor style of the 80s music videos, how they were shot. And I think he directed a film called Razorback, which no one had heard of. And then Highlander was really his first big film in 86. He went on to do the sequel, Highlander 2, film Ricochet, I believe is with Denzel Washington, and The Shadow with Alec Baldwin in 94. Then not much, then kind of went into television, and he's been doing TV pretty much ever since. I think at this point, he's directing the series Teen Wolf on television. In terms of the soundtrack was one of the, originally scored by Michael Kamen, along with Queen, and interestingly enough, any Marillion fans out there, the British rock band Marillion turned down the chance to record the soundtrack. They were offered it first, and they had just come there. I'm a big fan of Marillion, actually. Back in the day when Fish was the lead singer, and I think at this point Fish still was with them. They were on tour, so they turned it down, and they talk about it now as like a missed opportunity. And then, of course, you know, it went to Queen soon after. And the lead singer, Fish, also was offered a part in the film at some point and had to pull out because of scheduling conflicts. So there is a sort of Marillion-Highlander crossover, if any Marillion fans out there. So the star of this film is Christopher Lambert, who is fairly unknown. He had done Greystoke, The Legend of Tarzan in 84, and he didn't speak a word of English. So he took the role for Highlander and had to learn his lines in English, which is part of why he sounds so strangely odd in the film, is that he did not speak a word of English before making it. So put that in your memory banks when you're processing Lambert's performance in this film. All right, so let's jump into Highlander. We start out with a black screen and red title text comes up, voiceover by Sean Connery, and it reads, quote, "From the dawn of time, we came moving silently down through the centuries, living many secret lives, struggling to reach the time of the gathering, when the few who remain will battle to the last. No one has ever known we were among you until now." And we're treated to Queen's song Prince of the Universe over credits, which is an awesome tune. So we're right into like a heavy rock and roll vibe. And with the music still cranking, we now open and we cut to following a wrestler coming out of like the stadium gate in a big arena. You know, it was like a Steadicam following him. I think a couple of fairly famous 80s wrestlers were used to do this scene. Now we cut away to this like flyaway camera, which is a pretty cool opening scene where it's almost like the cameras that are used when you watch NFL games now, how they're on these wires and strung up all around the gridiron, pretty much. This was kind of the prototype of that was created by Mulcahy and his team. And you see the camera kind of swirling around the ring. It was all computer controlled, so they had to program the whole thing and then do the scene, and the camera would go and do its thing. It was all controlled by wires, and it's really cool, and it zooms in and out. One thing about this film, I will say, it does have its flaws, but every now and again, Mulcahy's camera does some really cool and fun stuff that, I don't know, it kind of helps the thing happen because of the way he shoots certain things. And it's not very consistent. His style in this film is very chock-a-block, but it's fun. And, you know, stuff like this, as you're opening into the film, boom, you know, here's this camera flying around in a cool way that in 1986 we haven't seen too much of. So at the end of this, the camera sort of zooms up and straight on to a figure sitting in the stands. He's, you know, shrouded by shadows. All we see is his eyes. And, of course, it's Connor McLeod. Of the Clan McLeod, and it's actor Christopher Lambert. And we immediately now flash back to the Scottish Highlands, and we're witness two clans are battling on this, you know, heath, this gray skies. Pretty well shot, you know, the scenes done in the past. For the most part, there's a couple of exceptions, but for the most part, they're really shot well by Mulcahy. And then we jump back inexplicably to Connor in the present, and suddenly he gets up and heads out of the stadium and into this empty parking lot, and we get our opening duel. And he's dressed very strangely. He's wearing an overcoat and sneakers, and the parking lot is completely deserted. And we've got Mulcahy's flying camera around now, giving us some tension. And then we close up on McLeod as he's walking in between these rows of cars, and a guy appears behind him. The character's name is Iman Fasil, and he's wearing, you know, aviator mirror sunglasses and a suit, and he's got a sword, which is kind of neat. And then McLeod pulls out his sword and they fight. He's got this wonderful katana, this Japanese katana sword. At one point in this battle, Fasil's glasses come flying off and they clatter on the ground, and the camera closes in on them, and we see a little bit of the battle through the reflection of the glasses. It made me think if the Wachowskis from The Matrix cribbed that. But anyway, I thought it was kind of cool. The fighting is pretty lame, as unfortunately most of the sword fighting in this film, you know, it's really really amazing fight choreography, kind of pre-Blade, if you will, pre-Matrix. Not done really well. Just, you know, they're kind of hitting each other's swords, and you're not really getting a sense that either combatant is terrifically skilled in any way. It's just kind of very clumsily shot. And, you know, we're really spoiled here in 2016 with how sword fights and martial arts choreography is done, that it's really, sometimes it's really hard to go back and watch some of these older films because the choreography really is dated. So the end of the fight, we see decapitation, kind of gruesome. We get the first instance now of the quickening, and we see the dead man's body sort of rise up in the air, and it starts to glow, and this blue lightning starts around, you know, very much Terminator-esque. I think Mulcahy took a lot of cues from the Terminator with this film, and I'll talk about that as I go. So then, of course, there's almost this bracing wind comes from nowhere, this incredibly bright light, and then tons of exploding car windows. And it has some kind of scope to it. There's something about it that is pretty cool when you're watching it. It's a little messy, but there is some kind of a style to things, again, that's compelling. Even from the start, McLeod is kind of an odd hero. Nothing he's done here looks at all remarkable. He kind of barely held his own in this duel with this guy. Without much sweat on either side, you didn't really, you know, it wasn't, they really, as I've said in probably earlier podcasts, that the best fights, whether it's hand-to-hand or sword, are done as little stories. You know, they see the Rocky movies for a beautiful example of how to do fights, where there are little stories within the fight, and the fight is told as a story, and you get through the fight, and the fight is interesting because it has dramatic stakes. And none of the fights in this film are like that, and this one was not like that at all. And we don't really get much sense that he's very good as a wielder of a sword, but you know, he did just have this sword battle. So then there's a really cool shot, as there are many in this film, and the camera leaves now McLeod, and it pans up and up and up, and then it goes to black, and it keeps going, and then as if it's sort of from the garage to Scotland in 1536, beautiful shots of this real castle called Ilion Donan. I'm probably not pronouncing it correctly, but Ilion Donan is the castle in Scotland. It's beautiful looking, and it's really shot well. We hear this really triumphant music, and we see MacLeod, same guy, long hair, of course, and riding off to war with a bunch of his buddies. And it really looks great. It does not look fake. You know, the castle is real. Everything looks very real in the scene. It's got a nice grit to it, which I really like. He has no Scottish accent at all, which is kind of funny. You know, but seeing that he didn't speak English, Lambert, before the film, you know, you kind of get it. You're just learning a language. You're not going to learn a dialect next. So it's kind of odd. And yet you can also read into it that, you know, these Highlanders are strange birds all on their own and that they're marked out as odd in whatever land they're in. So, you know, you can take it as you will. So then there's a banner of this other clan and their soldiery coming up over the hill and this weird lightning. And we see the Kurgan for the first time, played by the awesome Clancy Brown, who's just this monstrous knight in this crazy armor. Really looks very cool. The Kurgan already knows about MacLeod, so we hear from their side of the battle that, you know, telling his men, you know, MacLeod is mine. No one's to kill him but me. And the battle scenes aren't bad. There's some scope to it. Kind of reminded me a little bit of Braveheart, which came, of course, much later. Some scope when he does the wide shots. And again, like the initial duel, there's not much actual strikes here. There's a lot of guys, you know, walking around yelling and swinging, but we don't really see too much actual sword on sword, not a lot of blood. One thing we do notice is that no one will fight with MacLeod, and he's walking around the battle like, why won't anyone fight with me, and so on and so forth. So the Kurgan approaches him right away and just swords him right in the chest and makes to decapitate him, but all of his buddies kind of come to his rescue and carry off the Kurgan. And this is the first time we hear, of course, the indelible line, there can be only one. And we hear the Kurgan say, another time, MacLeod, and he's carried off by these, you know, all the soldiers. They can't kill him, but they can at least pull him away from MacLeod so he can possibly survive. So now we cut right back to the parking garage present day. As MacLeod is leaving the parking garage, he's stopped by all these cops. He's cuffed and taken in. Then we're back to Scotland. So there's a brief scene of all of his clan around him. He is quite dead, and we see it in the frame. And his girlfriend and all of his friends are kind of crying over his corpse. And then, boom, we're right back in the modern crime scene. Now, this is a funny sequence because the guy playing the police detective by the name of Frank Moran is none other than Alan North. Now, if you know, if you're a fan of The Naked Gun, if you're really, really an intense fan of the Zucker Brothers and Airplane, you will remember Police Squad, which was a very short-lived comedy show on TV. I think it was only like six episodes, and then it was canceled. And it's sort of a send-up of the police genre, the way Airplane was a send-up of the disaster movie genre done on TV. And there's six episodes. Seek them out. They're brilliant. However, the guy who plays Captain Ed Hocken in Police Squad is none other than Alan North. So the first time that I ever saw Alan North was in Police Squad. So, you know, when I see him later on in Highlander as a real police detective, kind of mugging for the screen the same way he used to mug in Police Squad, it's kind of humorous. So there'll be a slice of fans out there who will know what I'm talking about. And it's really funny to watch him play supposedly a real detective. So it's a really bad scene, unfortunately. Some really bad dialogue. Like, it could be right out of Police Squad. And Lambert is bad. Alan North is bad. It's like, so, Nash, guy went, you know, strolling down in the parking lot last night, lost his head. You like parking lots, Nash? Nash is MacLeod's name in this present. So it's really bad. We cut in and around this scene now elsewhere in the police department. And we meet forensic pathologist Brenda Wyatt, played by an actress named Roxanne Hart. It was pretty good. Looking at the decapitated corpse, we hear about a similar killing over in Jersey. So, you know, our ears are pricked up that something else is going on as well. And Brenda finds the dead man's sword. It's this very rare sword that, you know, MacLeod's opponent used. And she, all of a sudden, her eyes kind of pop up. Then we're back in the interrogation room. Oh, the dialogue is really bad. And it's really homophobic. There's a Alan North is sitting in front of him at an interrogation, and there's a beat cop who's really rough with him when he arrested him earlier over on the side. And they're having this battle of words. Like, you a faggot, Nash? You know, trading gay slurs. Like, it's really bad. There's a couple of lines that are so bad they're actually funny. You know, they don't know why Nash was there, and Nash won't admit it. And so the beat cop is like, I bet you went down there in the garage for a blowjob and just didn't want to pay for it. And then Nash is like, you're sick. And he attacks him. It's like, it's a really bad scene. Like, it's just, it's homophobic. It's just bad. It's dated. It's terrible. So luckily, you know, we cut away from that to a brief shot of the Kurgan cruising out somewhere. Now, this is where I think very much Russell Mulcahy cribbed a lot from Terminator, because the Kurgan's entry into New York City is very similar to the Terminator's entry into Los Angeles. Very similar how he looks, what he's wearing, the motel room stuff that's going to come. So just very interesting. The last few viewings I've had of Highlander, it's really stuck in my head of like, he really cribbed from Terminator big time. So we hear the next song from Queen, Master of Our Destiny, which is a great song. Give me the prize, the line. We see the Kurgan in a hotel room, getting a room. In the room, very Terminator-like, he takes out this briefcase and his sword is in pieces, and we watch him like snap it together and he practices with it. And it's a cool looking sword. It's kind of ridiculous on one hand, but it's really massive and chunky looking. And even Clancy Brown is just massive. He's just an amazingly huge dude. He looks incredible. And we hear his voice, at last, the gathering, you know, so something's happening. So back at the police station, we're with Brenda. She runs tests on the metal from the sword. And then Nash is let go, so he's able to leave. He goes back in the parking lot. And before the cops had come earlier, he had thrown his katana up on top of a light, hiding it where no one had found it. So he retrieves it, and then he hides as Brenda comes down with a flashlight in hand. When he decapitated Fazal, his sword bit into the side of like a pillar, and she sees the cut. It's like it was that sharp. And so she pulls a bunch of metal shards out of it, and they both leave. Then kind of a cheesy scene, Brenda goes to a bar to have a couple of drinks. McCloud is there, you know, or Nash, as he is known. There's a Queen ballad now is playing. She walks over to him, and he's like, I'd like to walk you home, Brenda. You know, it's just very goofy and creepy. But, you know, she knows who he is, obviously, because she was downtown at the police station. So as he leaves, she follows him. He kind of figures it out, and he waits for her. And when she appears, and, you know, he surprises her, and the Kurgan appears out of nowhere, and we have our first battle. The Kurgan definitely outmatches McCloud here. He's way stronger. And McCloud has to battle him using like found objects. And it's pretty stylishly directed, very odd angles every time they're fighting to hide the fact that there's really not much choreography and there's no real shape to the fight. So, you know, they're battling around, and suddenly the police helicopter arrives and we hear the Kurgan, another time, Highlander, and he takes off, you know. Another very dramatic moment. There's always these, you know, coming together, and the Kurgan is always foiled from taking McCloud's head, you know, time after time. So it's kind of part of the deal here. So then we are back in 1500th Scotland. Connor, quite alive now, comes into this local pub where all of the townsfolk are there, and they're all freaked out by it. No one will talk to him, even his girlfriend. And his girlfriend basically is leading the charge that he should be burned. He's got the devil in him. We briefly cut then to him with a yoke around his neck, being, you know, throwing stuff at him. He's being kind of run out of town, you know, very Christ-like, right? And the town goes completely apeshit. And the girl, his ex-girlfriend, is like in spasms of ecstasy. Burn him! You know, completely freaked out. The one guy, Angus, who's kind of his best friend, convinces the crowd to let him go and like saves his life. And so he leaves. So, you know, we're continuing to get McCloud's backstory, which is great. I mean, it does build him into a character of some kind. We get to see all this. So I kind of like how the film does these parallel narratives. We're building what happens to him from, you know, kind of his immersion as an immortal back in his village to the present day. Like, we see it happen, you know, because of the things that happened to him, right? He's been thrown out, and what's going to happen to his girlfriend later on, and the aging and his, you know, immortality. There is a bit of a tragic grandeur that happens. If Lambert was any decent kind of an actor, I mean, it happens anyway, I think, even with Lambert, you know, sawing the scenery as he does. So it's kind of neat. So we cut back to Nash Antiquities, and we see that, you know, he's now founded this antiquities business. He's in this warehouse. It's like, you know, the dream apartment you would ever want to have in your life. There's an inner sanctum we see, and there's all this wealth, basically wealth of centuries that he's collected over the years. Then, boom, we're yanked back in time. And at this point now, we see him living alone in a small castle with a woman whose name is Heather. Beautiful landscape, the Stone Castle, and is the arrival of Sean Connery as Ramirez, the Spaniard with the Scottish accent, as I like to call it. This film is very weird in that the Scotsman, MacLeod, has no accent, a weird accent, and the Spaniard from, you know, Egypt speaks like a Scotsman. Very funny. Connery looks great. He's in his Spanish outfit with his tilted cap with a feather in it. Really looks cool. And we witness, you know, other than cutting off other Highlanders' heads, the quickening is something that also just happens from time to time. They don't really tell us, but there are times when Highlanders will kind of witness and experience this quickening as just a matter of course. Ramirez is out in the sort of on the heath with MacLeod, and there's this big storm, and the lightning is coming down, and we hear Ramirez say, "It's the quickening." So from there, we're then launched back. Lots of jumps in this film. Back to New York City, to a police station. Brenda is now wanting to find out a bit about Nash, and she steals his file from her boss's, Frank Moran's, desk. And we find out that Brenda has written a book in her spare time called The Metallurgical History of Ancient Sword Making. So, you know, we're getting her sense of why she's so fascinated by the blade, by the metal and all that. Then back again to Ramirez and Connor. And this time we're out in a boat and Ramirez is teaching him balance. And we find out that Ramirez is actually Egyptian, was born like 2,000 years ago. He tosses Connor off the boat and Connor is screaming that he can't swim. And we hear the first time in the film that Ramirez says, "You're immortal." And so he sinks to the bottom. We see him clowning around underwater, completely able to breathe and completely fine, and walks out of the sea. And we don't know why. When, you know, it's one nice thing, I guess, about this film, which I'm sure when they redo it, they'll spoil it. But they leave the mystery of no one really knows where these immortals came from or why they are immortal and what this prize is all about. It just is, you know, like they just have it as a thing. I don't think you can get away with that in modern films anymore. I think test audiences would scream they need to know everything, you know. But I like that there's a mystery here that we don't really know why, because it just, you know, it adds to the mystique of who they are. We're not given this very, you know, like this horrible sequel talks about how they were aliens and came to Earth and all that. And it just ruins it, I think. So it's cool. And then we hear a little bit of the lore from Ramirez. And he says, you know, what you feel is the quickening. And someday you will feel an irresistible pull towards a faraway land to fight for the prize. It will be called The Gathering. And so now we have our full-on training sequence. And we don't know why Ramirez is training Connor, says one of them will, someday one of them will have to die in order to gain the prize. But, you know, we're not told that either, and there you go. So we have our training sequence, and we hear that, and it's, you know, they lay the rules out. He's like, you know, you can't really die, he said, but if your head comes away from your body, it's over. So that's kind of a, you know, it's done in a very offhand manner, which I kind of like. Beautiful shots of I'm assuming he filmed a lot of this in Scotland, really beautiful shots of the landscape. And we also hear another little tidbit that only on holy ground are you truly safe, because for whatever reason, some ancient law that none will violate. Again, another mystery, like what does Christianity have to do with the Highlanders and the prize and the gathering? We don't know. We're never told. I like that. So then we witness the actual power that they have, which I think is really neat. It's so it's more of like a 60s, 70s idea of power. These days, you know, in movies, power is really all about control and domination. And the power that the Highlanders have is to become one with other living beings. And so we see Ramirez showing him how to do it. And, you know, looking at this stag that's out in the wild and breathing and imagining he's there, feeling its heart, running with it. And they both run on the beach, and really wonderful. Just a real nice that this is their power, that they can connect to other living things in this way. There's a lot of helicopter shots. You know, we see them doing things in the training sequence, and then there are these helicopter shots of way out, and we're really getting the landscape and seeing them very small in the screen. Reminded me of what Jackson does a lot in Lord of the Rings, and I wonder if he copped it from Mulcahy, you know? We also find out they're sterile. They cannot have children. And now Ramirez is talking to MacLeod and saying, because MacLeod is with Heather at this point, he's like, "You must leave her, brother." He's like, "You know, you don't want to go through what I went through." And we hear the story of, you know, at one point, I guess Ramirez really having a full-on love. You know, he aged out of her, basically, you know, was alive for her entire life. She grew old and died, and he would spare MacLeod that heartbreak, which is great. I think that's a great kind of tragic thing, which I like.
The economics of the future are somewhat different. You see, money doesn't exist in the 24th century.
I can't wait for that day, but unfortunately, it is not here yet. I want to just tell you a little bit about how you can contribute and support Sci-Fi on Screen. You can do it with Patreon. And Patreon works by doing it, you donate per show. So as I post a show, you would contribute to Patreon. And you can do it as little as like a dollar per show if you want. You can go to the site, patreon.com. There's a link on the scifionscreen.com website. And you sign up and set your amount. And every time I publish a podcast, you would contribute that amount automatically. And you can stop and start whenever you like. It's easy to navigate. And what's good about it is, you know, you're not just sending me money and forgetting about it. If I don't publish a podcast for whatever reason, there's no money debited. So I think it's a really great way to support podcasts in general. If you'd like to do a one-time donation to Sci-Fi on Screen, you can do it via PayPal, and you can search PayPal with the Sci-Fi on Screen email, which is scifionscreen@gmail.com. And you can go right to PayPal, and you can you could support Sci-Fi on Screen that way. You can also support us by retweeting the show on Twitter, share the show on your Facebook page, and be happy to write a review on iTunes of the show. And you can also, if you are interested in any of the archived editions of Sci-Fi on Screen, I've done about 89, 90 shows. They're all on my webpage, and there's a part of the page called Podcast Index by Film Title, and it's all alphabetical, so you can go and look for your favorite films and download for free.
Gonna crack my knuckles and jump for joy. I got a clean bill of health from Dr. McCoy.
So they talk briefly about the Kurgan, that he's from an ancient people from the steppes of Russia, a very cruel people. And of all the immortals, he is the strongest, the perfect warrior. You know, Ramirez says if he wins the prize, it's kind of curtains for humanity. What a being like that would do with this ability to, you know, we're not exactly sure what the prize is yet, but whatever prize it is, we're told right now, if the Kurgan wins it, it's kind of curtains for peeps. So now we have a very bizarre scene that's not done very well. Somehow, Connor is gone somewhere, and Ramirez is having dinner with Heather in the castle, and Ramirez senses the Kurgan, and the Kurgan just enters the castle, and they have this fight. It's a weird fight because it's cool in a sense. There are some cool moments where you see Ramirez is really the better swordsman, and he wounds him in the throat, which gives the Kurgan his distinctive voice, which he has later. The swordplay is not very great. It's kind of clunky. The problem here is that the Kurgan is like, they start inside the castle. Every time the Kurgan misses a strike, he takes out a wall. And so by the time of, you know, this whole battle is over, you know, they're fighting on a sort of a lone staircase, and all the walls of the castle have been knocked down by the Kurgan. It's just a little weird and absurd. And Mulcahy focuses, you know, consistently on the Kurgan knocking out entire walls. It's a really weird fight. There's some dramatics to it because Connery is such an awesome actor. Even in a film like this, you already love him and want him to live and think he's a great guy. So you kind of sense that he's going to lose, even though he's kind of beaten the Kurgan now and again, that the Kurgan just won't die. They end on this, you know, parapet, very, very kind of fake-looking end of stairwell, and finally the Kurgan beats Ramirez and beheads him, and then they have this massive quickening scene. The whole thing looks a little bit like a music video set, I have to say. This is where, at one point, Mulcahy fails completely. It's a goofy, goofy scene. So now we cut to a scene in World War II, and we've seen before at Nash's antiques company that he's got an administrative assistant who seems to kind of know his deal and protects him the few times that Brenda has come to sort of find him. And now we see Nash, it's World War II, and he's somewhere in Europe on a battlefield, and he finds this small girl hiding. This is the girl who now is older than him in the present day, has become his personal assistant. Her name is Rachel. She's kind of his confidant and the only person in the world other than the other Highlanders who kind of know his secret. So I thought it was kind of cool. Brenda has invited Nash to her apartment for dinner, ostensibly to kind of find out a little more about him. We see her before he comes over, hiding a gun, putting a recording device in another box, you know. He comes in, he's very cocky and smarmy. It's, you know, like, there was a weird smarmy cockiness that male heroes in film used to exhibit in certain genre films that's like, so does not travel well. I mean, see Bill Murray in the, you know, the two Ghostbusters films. Like, there's still, you know, the first one's still a funny film, but there's a smarminess about him as he's going after Sigourney Weaver in the first film that just like, it doesn't really travel well down the decades now. And there's a lot of this in this film where, you know, he's kind of coming on to her in this weird, creepy way. And, you know, back then it was supposed to be charming. Ugh. But anyway, so there's a few fun things here. There are cops outside her apartment that she doesn't know about because Moran found out that she was snooping his files, and so he's had her watched. He finds the tape recorder in the box. He finds the gun. And then there's this great moment where he opens some brandy that she had, very old brandy. I don't know if she had it or he brought it. But he's like, I remember that year. You know, he starts speaking about all the things that happened in 1783, you know, and, your country was newly born and all this stuff. And it's great. But she fesses up and she's like, I've got to find this sword that killed Fazal. A sword like this shouldn't exist. It's made in a way that wasn't discovered at a certain period of time, 2,000 sort of years earlier. And I want to find out why. So. Now we cut back in time. Heather has somehow survived the Kurgan because after the Kurgan decapitated Ramirez, you know, he was sort of, you know, you're my. We see him sort of, you know, lurking and stalking Heather, and then we cut away. So at this point, we're years past that. Heather is still living with Connor. She has aged. We hear the wonderful Queen song, Who Wants to Live Forever. She has white hair now, very old. And there's a really... It should have been a better scene, but it's a really bad scene with them as she's in bed dying. And it's just so badly written and really cheesy. For me, sometimes with movies, a scene will be set up in such a way that the import of what's supposed to happen in the scene is enough for me to kind of still get a sense of the scene, even though the scene is done really badly. So when I sit there thinking about how this woman is dying, that Connor has lived with all these years, and even though it's terrible, that the idea is still so sound, it's still so dramatically sound that he's experiencing this heartbreak and loss that Ramirez warned him against, that it still kind of affects me, even though I would never defend the scene ever. Like, it's a really not a good scene, but it's set up with such a cool idea and it's such a tragic kind of circumstance that it still works. Just a very strange thing that this movie does once in a while. So once she dies, he burns the house they live in and takes off. We cut back to New York now, and another Highlander named Castagir meets McLeod on this famous bridge in Central Park, which has been in like every rom-com ever created. And again, they're friends. They're sort of palling around together. They both realize it's the gathering, but they're not fighting. They reminisce about a duel in the 1700s, and we go back there and we see it. It's kind of a comedic moment where it's a sword duel, and McLeod loses like 7-8 times. His opponent keeps stabbing him and killing him, and he keeps getting up. And at one point, you know, the other guy finally freaks out and runs away. It's kind of a funny moment. That doesn't mean anything in the film per se, but it's kind of a comedic moment dealing with what it's like to be an immortal. So then we cut back to present day, and we're with the Kurgan as he's leaving his apartment, and we see his horrible scar that he got from Ramirez, and now we kind of put two and two together in terms of his voice. And then we cut to this other weird thing. Now we follow some kind of vigilante Death Wish guy in a red Trans Am. He's like cruising around with a, you know, bag full of weapons, you know, all jacked up, looking for a fight, basically. And at one point, we see the Kurgan fighting Castagir, who was just with Connor, in this empty lot. And it's a brief duel, not much, and Kurgan takes Castagir's head. We witness the quickening, you know, a lot of things explode, a lot of glass, as usual. And then this vigilante runs up and riddles the Kurgan with bullets. But of course, you know, he's immortal. And then he gets up and impales the guy basically with his sword, holding him up on his sword and then tossing him like across the lot, which is a pretty great Kurgan moment. We see the quickening energy come out of Castagir and enter the Kurgan. Now, it's a pretty cool scene, the way he shoots it. There's a lot of light. And again, the wind blowing, as is always. It's always wind blowing in the quickening scenes. And then there's a bit of weird comedy at the end of this where the Kurgan jumps in a car with an old couple, and he throws the old man out. And he gets in the front seat, and there's this old woman next to him. And he's like, you know, sticking out his tongue and saying goofy stuff and driving around. And like, you know, it's just an odd jag of comedy. So now we cut to the police detective, and the guy who the Kurgan stabbed, believe it or not, didn't die. And Moran shows the guy a picture of Nash, thinking, you know, they pretty much think Nash is the big sword killer. The guy very specifically points out, no, it's not him. This guy was big, definitely not him. And it's weird, in this scene, Mulcahy is so restless. Rather than just shoot the scene for what it's worth, he puts the camera all over the place. If you watch the scene where the vigilante is getting questioned, like every cut, the camera is tucked away in some other weird place. It's above, it's below, it's under this, it's over there. It's really strange. I think Mulcahy got a little restless with the, you know, the pace of things. So now we get another great idea. And this, you know, one thing I should have said in the beginning, this film is so chock-a-block with awesome ideas, which is why I think it's a cult favorite that is begs to be remade. It's so full of cool ideas. So now we get this notion of Brenda is researching who Nash is, and she's found this guy to do some research. We find out that, you know, Nash's actual name on the birth certificate, that the person whose name he has died as a baby. And it's a great idea in terms of detective story in the film, and like, how does Nash hide his identity down through the centuries? And at some point, the person he's masquerading is declared dead, but that person bequeaths the money to a stillborn child, and he takes that child's name and becomes that child. And this way, he's able to keep, you know, if you think about it, it's kind of an interesting thing of like, if you were immortal, like, how would you keep all of your money at some point? You know, you would have to figure out a way to bequeath your money to a descendant and then actually become that descendant. So it's very clever in that way. So we see all that. The kicker is they show all the signatures from all these descendants that go back as far as written records have come back. And the computer does this thing where it takes a letter from each word. It shows that the signatures actually match, and he's been the same person. And this researcher is like, so here you got a dead guy, you know, knocking around the world since the 1700s. You know, we know, of course, it's much earlier, but it's a great little moment. It's a great aha moment in a film that's mostly action, you know, to have this little detective moment of like how the immortals are, how an immortal would be outed in a way. So I kind of like it. So now we get our church scene, which McLeod is in church and the Kurgan enters, and of course, it's sacred ground. So McLeod is lighting a candle for obviously Heather and Ramirez. So the Kurgan comes in and he starts putting candles out with his hands. He confronts McLeod, tells him that they're the last two and they're going to battle for the prize. And then Kurgan starts bragging about Ramirez. And he's like, you know, you're like your friend Ramirez. I took his head and raped his woman. You know, McLeod at that moment realizes he never knew that the Kurgan raped Heather. So they trade barbs. But of course, McLeod now has a little fire under his belly for the final battle. So when Nash gets home, Brenda is there, and there's this final confrontation and confession of who he is. You know, she wants to believe it, but it's still so incredible. He admits it. And to prove himself, he grabs her hand, and he stabs himself with a dagger, and she looks for the wound. After a few minutes, finds nothing. He gets up. Then we have a love scene and a love theme from Queen and Michael Kamen, you know, their moment of consummation. And then at some point, you know, of course, we have to have a kidnapping, right? This is, you know, an 80s/90s action movie. So somehow when they're not together, the Kurgan kidnaps her. And there's this really dumb scene where the Kurgan's playing chicken and she's covering her eyes, and he's, you know, Clancy Brown is mugging for the camera like there's no tomorrow. And then he's running down his innocent bystanders, which is really kind of bizarre. It's a weird tone. There are times when some things with the Kurgan take on a really weird tone in this film. And the killing of innocent bystanders here is just really weird. It's done in a very cavalier manner, so it's kind of odd. And it goes on for a little too long, I think. So Nash gets home, gets a voice message from the Kurgan. Of course, you know, I have your girl, and here's where I'll be. And so we have, the classic climax at Silver Cup Studios here in New York, out in Queens. You know, it's a classic 80s end-of-the-movie showdown, right? Lots of steam, kind of a warehouse-like atmosphere. You know, I don't know, whoever did that first, you know, like in the 80s and 90s, it was like if you didn't have an action movie that ended at the docks or the warehouse or in some, you know, place with a lot of steam and industrial machinery, you know, like it wasn't a real movie, right? It was just, it's so replicated in so many movies. So the fight starts on the Silver Cup sign. Rachel is tied to the sign, right? A little dramatic. He's trying to untie Rachel. Every time their blades touch, there's sparks, which is kind of cool. And I guess it's the quickening is so strong in either of them that, you know, the power is jumping out via the metal, which is neat. And then there's the water tank on top of the building bursts, and now they're hip deep in water, which is really kind of odd. And Brenda is hanging off the sign like a, you know, Hollywood heroines of old, screaming. And then at one point, they fall through the roof onto an empty soundstage below. And this is the classic, all the classic shots that we know of the Highlander in the final duel. There's nothing on this soundstage, and the ground is very shiny. And Russell Mulcahy is pulling out all of his music video tricks. The camera is like, you know, running really fast, close to the ground, going one direction as the two combatants are going in another direction. You know, all of his cool little music video type shots of the time, which are really cool. They look great. There's a lot of scenes of them sort of in profile with light behind them. He's about to be decapitated by the Kurgan, and Brenda saves him by knocking the Kurgan behind, and then Connor saves her. So no story to the fight, like I said, no real choreography, just a lot of clanging swords, a lot of music, a lot of running around. And then at some point, you know, McLeod it's very unsatisfying because he takes a swipe at the Kurgan, and is that classic, they've done it in a few movies now, where the bad guy doesn't know he's dead until he laughs, and then of course his head flops off. It's a very unelegant, unsatisfying ending, because we don't really get some sense of McLeod really besting the Kurgan. It just kind of ends, you know. And now we have like the quickening on steroids. And of course, there's all kinds of glass windows on the floor. So we have this crazy quickening and all the glass breaks. Everything shatters. He's lifted off the floor. There's a lot of demons around him that look almost hand-drawn. They're really bad. They must have run out of money because the effects here are like really, really bad. The effects in Ghostbusters are better than these. Like they're actually hand-drawn, sketched demons that are kind of swirling around him, almost like an anime. Like it's terrible. But we do hear the cool thing that he knows everything. He is everything. He is one with everything. And again, what a cool prize. What a cool idea that is the prize, that he can, you know, act as an intermediary between different nations and heads of nations to foster communication and understanding. I think that's really, I love that. And I think that's very unique about this film. Now we're back in the Highlands where he was born, but it's present day. It's him and Brenda. He knows what everyone is thinking. We hear that he's going to, you know, that he's going to help them understand each other. Bit of a Ben Kenobi, you know, voiceover from Ramirez. You've done it, Highlander, so on and so forth. And we don't really know if he's really alive or McLeod is imagining him. And then we are out. So brief summary. It's full of, at this point, 1986, the movie was made, you know, it's like 40 some odd years old, 50 years old. It doesn't really hold up too well, but it's fun to watch still. And I think it's amazing, you know, in terms of style, it's kind of a Terminator rip. It's got a lot of really bad scenes, really bad dialogue. Lambert is terrible. I'm sorry. I mean, I know you diehard Highlander fans out there, but he's really bad. He's really bad. I mean, he's part of the charm of the film as a cult movie, but man, is he bad. It's a strange animal because the music by Queen and Michael Kamen and Mulcahy's camera work and the concept of the film still make it watchable. It's crazy to think about. It's still very watchable. And there's awesome Clancy Brown, who's just so charming and awesome. And Connery's great as well. So you have Connery and Clancy Brown really providing the really cool characters. And then, you know, so Lambert is kind of balanced in a weird way. I come back to this film every 5 or 6 years. I'm just able to watch it. And I think this film has got so many cool ideas in it, you know, in terms of the immortals. First of all, coming down through time, how it's telling the story. It's telling the story in flashback and in real time. And not only are they immortals, but somehow when they kill each other, they gain each other's power. There's a prize at the end down through the centuries. So as they're living, they're all waiting for this time way in the future when they're all going to gather to fight for the prize. The prize itself is the ability to connect and be one with all living things. Amazingly cool. And all that stuff is really neat. The camera work of Mulcahy's is great. You know, there's a lot of clunky scenes in it, but there's a lot of really cool scenes. And his camera gives scope to things. So even when the story's a little thin or something's a little goofy, you know, the next moment you're in another great scene with some cool camera work, you know. So I really like Highlander as a genre movie. I won't defend it to people who think it's a piece of crap. But, you know, I grew up in this time. I saw this film back in when I was in my late teens, early 20s. And I think it's great in terms of a film. To me, it's like, and I'll get to that because I'm going to go through the sort of history of the franchise as we go forward, because this is like the most, you know, it's a movie that's fairly interesting to watch and really cool, but man, it is like the worst produced franchise in cinema history. Not that it even has the greatest film. You know, you can argue and say that the first Matrix is awesome and that the latter two are kind of not that great. But this is the first film that was like, the ideas were great and execution was spotty, but then it even went downhill afterwards. So I will get to that. I'm going to do a little trivia first and then I'll get to sort of the history of the franchise. A little bit of trivia. In the scene following Connor beheading the Kurgan, Mulcahy had originally envisioned an animated dragon with the Kurgan's battle helmet emerging from his decapitated body and challenging Connor again. Only after Connor had defeated this ghost dragon would he have received the final quickening and subsequent prize. The idea was eventually cut due to budget constraints, thankfully. Queen originally intended to record only one song for the film, but after reviewing footage from the movie, they were so inspired they wrote a whole bunch more. The band members each had a favorite scene and composed songs specifically for each scene. Brian May wrote Who Wants to Live Forever during the cab ride home after seeing the film. Roger Taylor used the line It's Kind of Magic as the basis for the end title song. So Queen were like really into this tune, into this movie. The sword sparking while clashing was accomplished by attaching a wire to each sword that led down the arms of the actors to a car battery. One was connected to the positive terminal and the other to the negative, so that when the swords touched, there was an arc. Very simple and clever in the scene effect, I thought. The opening scene was intended to take place during an NHL hockey match, but supposedly the NHL refused to allow the crew to film there because, by the crew's own admission, they were intending to emphasize the violence of the hockey match. In the Scottish festival scene, Ramirez shows MacLeod his sword, claiming it was made by his last father-in-law, Masamune. And there was a real Masamune. His name was Goro Masamune, who was renowned as the greatest swordsmith of the Tokugawa shogunate era. After filming the scene where the Kurgan confronts MacLeod in the church, Clancy Brown actually apologized to the priest and the nuns who were there for real for his character's dialogue for fear that he had offended them. All right, so let's talk about the franchise. This is a crazy franchise. In 1991, you had Highlander 2, The Quickening, which was this bizarre plot where the ozone layer is deteriorating, so MacLeod helps to invent the shield that covers the Earth, but it also cuts off the sun. And at the same time, we also find out that the Immortals were actually a race of aliens who came to Earth, so on and so forth. They retcon Connery, and they bring him back in this movie. It's a pretty terrible film. In its own right. So unless you're really, you know, a completist, don't bother. However, in 1992 through 1998, there was a television series starring Adrian Paul as Duncan MacLeod, which is sort of a cousin of Connor. You know, I've watched a couple of episodes, and to me, it's a little dated. But, you know, there are some people who really think it's the best part of the Highlander franchise besides the initial film. You know, it goes 5-6 seasons, however many years. It has a lot of arcs, and, you know, it does its thing. So if you're interested in this, again, there is a TV series from 92 to 98. In 1994, Highlander 3, The Sorcerer was released, which was alternately titled Highlander, The Final Dimension. So this movie contradicts both the second film and the TV series, acting as a standalone sequel to the original film. MacLeod battles a warrior who missed the original gathering because he was buried deep in a Japanese cave that is holy ground, isolating him from the supposedly final contest of the first film. Kane, played by Mario Van Peebles, is a master of the, quote, power of illusion, end quote, which allows him to create false imagery to deceive his enemies. Connor, who has lived with his adopted son, John, for years, with the belief that he is the final immortal, must return to New York and finish the job he started back in 1985. Along the way, he finds a new love, Dr. Alex Johnson. The movie was a box office bomb. The critics and fans excoriated it. I tried to watch it. I think I watched half of it. And man, is it bad. I mean, it's like, it's so direct-to-video bad that it's embarrassing. 15 years later, on September 1st, 2000, Highlander Endgame was released and was an attempt to merge characters from both the original film and the TV series. So the story in this film follows Duncan MacLeod as he confronts Jacob Kell, an evil immortal who has assembled a group of fellow warriors, as well as an impressive body count. Kell, who holds a centuries-old grudge against the elder Connor MacLeod, has slain Connor's dearest loved ones, and he does not follow the traditions of single combat. Connor has spent a decade trying to escape the game in a hidden Watcher fortress known as the Sanctuary. But he and Duncan are forced to confront this new threat that neither one of them can alone succeed against. As the two McClouds will not break the single combat tradition, Connor convinces Duncan to decapitate him, thus gaining the power that he needs to defeat Kell. This directly contradicts Highlander 2, The Quickening, in which Connor McCloud is seen in the future as an old man. However, Highlander 2 also features a method whereby one immortal can resurrect another, so it does not necessarily create a paradox. Critical reaction to Highlander Endgame was negative. It holds a 12% on Rotten Tomatoes. It was a box office bomb. I tried watching it, and it was as bad as Highlander 3, The Sorcerer. Then the final live-action film was called Highlander, The Source, and it was a direct-to-video on Sci-Fi Channel. The film follows Duncan MacLeod and a group of fellow immortals seeking the source of immortality. And this film retcons the meaning of the game and the phrase, there can be only one. And I didn't even bother with this. So elsewhere you see reactions to it that it's been given a pretty terrible review in its own right. And then there was an anime done maybe 4 or 5 years ago called Highlander, The Search for Vengeance, which, you know, probably the best of all of the sequels. It's not bad. It's not very good either. It's more of like an action movie with a little bit of a dusting of the Highlander mythology. There's a reboot now in the works. There's been a reboot in the works forever. My suspicion is that the rights of this are held by a bunch of different people and they can't get anyone to agree on who's going to direct it, who's going to be in it. You know, it's amazing to me that this concept is almost foolproof. Like, there's so many good ideas in this whole concept that, I mean, if someone could come along and finally sit down and work this all out, you'd probably get a really great film. Because even with all the problems of the original, the conceptual framework of the thing is so powerful that it's still compelling and watchable, and you still come away with it jazzed. I do, anyway, as a genre film watcher. I'm still jazzed, like, wow, what a neat concept. You know, however they did okay and not did okay at certain points, it's still an amazing concept. So I feel like the concept is so strong that someone's got to do this right. You know, someone's just got to sit down and hash all this out and maybe come up with another 2-3 films in the modern day. It'd be so cool. You could do so much with it in terms of flashing back to historical eras and variations on the prize and the quickening and all these different things. And the fight choreography now that they could do with these sword fights would be off the charts. I mean, who wouldn't go to see a movie that was peppered with like sword fights, regardless of what the plot was, you know? I have hopes that someone figures this series out. They deal with all the rights issues and straighten it all out and get the bloody reboot up, and let's see someone else take a crack at it. That's all I've got to say about the Highlander film and the franchise, and I will see you next time.